Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Sometimes history makes it easy for us to know exactly who invented something or did something first. But music history is rarely that simple. And when it comes to punk rock, well, that creation story gets pretty murky pretty fast. Here's one thing we do know. Punk Magazine, which was around between 1975 and 79, did not come up with the term.
Punk rock had been a term that had been in use for several years. Cream Magazine put Alice Cooper on the cover as Punk of the Year in 1974, so I thought everybody in the world knew what it was.
That's Punk Magazine co-founder John Holstrom, who we'll hear more from later when he joins us to talk about his recent book, Looking Back at the Magazine's History. We'll also look back at what could possibly have been the first ever punk band, a trio of brothers from Detroit who called themselves Death. We'll talk with one of the band's founding members and the creator of a documentary about their amazing story. But no matter what punk creation myth you believe, there's no denying that today, the band Savages is creating its own take on punk to great acclaim. Savages has recently been hailed as one of the best new bands to come out of the UK. Their debut album is called Silence Yourself. It's out now, and they're with us in the Soundcheck studio today to play some of it for us live. This is the song Cities Fall, played by Savages on Soundcheck.
So many skimpity girls around.
The band Savages, live on Soundcheck with a song called Cities Full. You'll find it on their debut album called Silence Yourself, but that's a live performance. Jenny Beth singing, Gemma Thompson playing guitar, Aisha Hassan playing the bass, and Faye Milton on drums. Jenny and Gemma joining me at the microphones.
Hello.
Guys, thank you so much for being here. A boring first question would be, how did your band get formed? But the striking thing about it is you guys came out of the box like fully formed. You seem to have such a clear kind of vision of who Savages were going to be. How did that happen so fast?
Well, we've all been playing music for years, really, in different formations. Aisha and myself have been playing music for about 5 years together. And I played in John and Jen and toured with them.
Which was, Jenny, your old band.
Not that old.
Previous band, I should say.
Each of us have a different background in music, but also together. So Faye Milton has a background in worldwide percussion. So we kind of took all the experiences we had and wanted to make something that was straight away an impact and focus on certain elements like the actual performance,
mm-hmm.
And just keep it simple, pared down, and try and find the first elements that we enjoy about the music we make, which is why the name Savages was quite fitting.
So it's more about being elemental than being literally savage.
Yeah, intent, I suppose.
Yeah.
Intent behind what you're doing.
Well, you know, one of the things that happened, of course, was, you know, you did this opening gig for British Sea Power, and then, you know, you had a couple of songs, and then people just started. A pretty prominent British critic proclaimed you guys the best new band in the UK. Very early on. Jenny, was there kind of a weight of expectation when it came time to actually make a full-length record?
No, I think we toured the songs for like a year, and then before we started thinking about recording, when we wrote the first songs, we never thought about recording in the first place. The songs were written with the idea of a performance behind it. What mattered to us is to think what kind of emotions this sound is creating, what is shape everything around the show, around a live, exciting, thing.
So you think of yourselves as a live band first.
Yeah, that was the old intent we had at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And to set ourselves different kind of goals and trying to achieve them with each song and trying to be quite thoughtful about what we were trying to achieve and then trying them out on stage. And
well, now there is, as you say, a kind of a thoughtful quality to a lot of what you do. I mean, people who check out your website will see that you've written a number of things. For example, Silence Yourself, the title of the album. You back that up in live performance recently by asking audiences to turn off their phones so that you're not playing to a sea of little blue screens.
Yeah, but that seemed really common sense to us. I don't, it's just, I think people are dying for these kind of things to stop from happening, but it's easier to do it in a group than, to think of it on your own. So it's just giving a bit, some kind of guidance or ideas that we... things we prefer to do, or,
Is there an irony to the title, Silence Yourself, when this music is... I mean, this is not background music. This is not for a quiet evening at home. This is loud, in-your-face, upfront music.
Yeah, that was intentional, to be played in the foreground.
Yeah, I mean, you can take that title numerous ways, but I suppose our main idea was to achieve a kind of focus... to kind of focus what you're trying to do, whether you're the viewer, the listener, or the performer.
Mm.
And to share that idea of focus is kind of the goal, I suppose.
And something that seems to have been, I mean, if anything has been lost, I'm not one of these people who says, oh, digital bad, analog, old days great. But one thing that I've noticed, I mean, it's happened to me as well, is the time that you spend actually just like shutting everything else out just to focus on the music that's in front of you, that is something. And the idea of focus and including your audience as kind of an active part of your concert, that idea seems it's an old-fashioned idea, but it seems kind of revolutionary again.
I suppose there are so many distractions.
Yeah.
All right. I think it's also the idea of when you're stepping out of the world and you remain silent for a while, it can already be seen as an act of resistance. And in itself, you know, you don't necessarily need to react to everything all mm-hmm. the time.
So how does the songwriting in Savages happen? Gemma, does Jenny come to you with a set of lyrics already done and then you write music around, or is it vice versa?
We don't really have any set way in terms of how they begin, like the actual thing that they begin with. But we do have a very similar process for each song, I suppose. It's about finding, trying to be quite minimal, trying to find something that works and not being afraid to repeat that, to try and drop anything that we don't think is necessary. And then to finish writing the songs during the performance, to actually let that performance finish shaping them. And maybe so they change each time we perform them sometimes, just mm-hmm. until they become a finished thing.
So there's a lot of repetition, Jenny, in the lyrics as there is in the music for the same reason.
Yeah, I like repetition. I like to find an intensity with repetition, how a word can be repeated several times and it changes its meaning. I suppose, instead of writing choruses with different kind of lines, just repeated in the same way.
Yeah. If you've been following this band, you know that their first song, the one that really sort of grabbed a lot of ears on both sides of the Atlantic, was a song called Husbands. That's what they're going to play for us next. Once again, Savages playing Husbands for us live on Soundcheck. Savages with a live performance of their song Husbands here in the Soundcheck studio. Jenny Beth singing, Gemma Thompson playing guitar, Faye Milton on drums, Aisha Hassan playing the bass. The album is called Silence Yourself. We are all huge fans here at Soundcheck, and this has been great having the four of you performing for
us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Next, a new documentary film tells the story of an early punk band from Detroit called Death, whose story was almost lost in an attic forever. We'll hear more next on Soundcheck. Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. In Detroit, in the 1970s, three brothers formed a band called Death. Now, the name might indicate this was not your typical Motown sound. A new documentary chronicles the story of a proto-punk group that never really caught a break until now. Death bassist and vocalist Bobby Hackney is here with me in the studio today. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, how you doing?
And filmmaker Jeff Howlett, one of the men behind a band called Death, is with us on the phone. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing, John?
I'm doing well. Look, I am not a particularly big guy. I hope I'm not a stupid guy. But I watched much of your film, Jeff, with a big, stupid grin plastered on my face. What a great story, and what a crazy story this is, of a band that never really gets off the ground, tapes in an attic for decades, and tapes, Bobby, that were made by you, your brother David, and your brother Dennis, which looks like Dennis, although everyone pronounces it Dennis, it seems.
Yeah, it's D-A-N-N-I-S. That's Dennis, right.
Right. So you're three black guys in Detroit who are not playing Motown. You're playing something that's much closer to what would become punk rock.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we, well, you know, we started out, I mean, we come from all that great legacy of Motown. I mean, you know, our mom and dad, you know, they, our first real, you know, run with 45s was the Chess record label. You know, we remember like the old Etta James and Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and, of course, Chuck Berry. Mm-hmm. All that stuff came into our house. But
now your dad was a minister, right?
Yeah, he was a Baptist minister, but he was in tune to a lot of history. So he had us to sit down to watch events like the March on Washington. And, of course, when the Beatles came in that February of 1964, it was just such an electric time in America. And everybody was tuned into it. And my dad, you know, we're on Sunday night, you know, watching Ed Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my dad says, I want you boys to sit down here because you're about to watch history being made.
Your dad said that.
My dad said that.
Your dad must
have
been the only dad in America who said that. Because most dads were like, what is this? Get this, people. I mean, look at them. They look like shaggy dogs.
Well, you know, he knew. I mean, that was the banter of everybody's life. I mean, on Sunday night, that was families got together and watched Ed Sullivan. So he really saw this as being a historic event, and he wanted us to sit down and watch it. Maybe he was just trying to get us to be good, you know? I don't know. But at any rate, he did tell us, and we sit down, and when we watched that, that planted the seeds for us wanting to be a band. And then, you know, of course, we went through the 60s, and, you know, growing up, we didn't really become full-fledged serious about being a band until about 1971. Mm-hmm. And we started a band, and we called ourselves Rockfire Funk Express, you know, because, you know, at the time, you know,
it was a safe name. You know which way you're going to go.
Yeah, exactly. Rock,
you're rock
funk, you know, everything that was kind of happening at the times. You know.
We're speaking with Bobby Hackney, bassist and vocalist of the Detroit band Death, and Jeff Howlett, one of the filmmakers behind the documentary, splendid documentary called A Band Called Death. So the three of you, you, Bobby, Dennis, and David, form this band. You're playing both sides with the rock and the funk, and then it's David.
Right.
Who comes up with the name for the band, which I want to get to in a moment. But, you know, did you guys know what you were doing, or were you just kind of like figuring it out as you went along?
I think that's what we were doing. You know, what we loved was we had seen all these great bands, you know, like Ted Nugent, the Amboy Dukes, Grand Funk Railroad, and we really loved that sound. We just immersed ourselves in rock and roll. I mean, it was my brother Dennis who really saw the first Alice Cooper concert that he saw. Really, it was by mistake because they were actually on their way to a Motown party, which was happening in another part of the facility. But they had to go through Cobo Arena, which Alice Cooper's concert was in progress at the time.
Wow.
So they're in the very back trying to get out the back
trying
door.
To get out.
But Dennis just becomes mesmerized with this, you know, I mean, he saw them on stage at Alice Cooper, the Billion Dollar Babies tour with this boa constrictor and everything. And Dennis just loved it. He loved the way the drummer played. And he came back home and he said, guys, we got to play this music.
And well, that you know, folks at this point have got to be wondering, what could this band have sounded like? Well, this is what Death sounded like back in the early 70s in Detroit.
1, 2, 3, now!
Just a little bit from the band Death, proto-punk from three brothers in Detroit in the early 1970s. Politicians in My Eyes is the song. The documentary is A Band Called Death. We're speaking with Bobby Hackney, Sr., the bassist and vocalist in the band, Jeff Howlett, one of the filmmakers behind the documentary. And Jeff, much of the documentary centers on how the name of the band affects their career. At what point in the making of this film did you realize that you had more than just, you know, kind of an unusual rockumentary on your hands?
Pretty much right out of the gate. I mean, I had a conversation with Bobby Hackney Jr., just sort of give me the whole gist of the story, and he just told me all these things about his family that were just so rich and beautiful. When we sat down and started interviewing Bobby Sr. and Dennis about it, I mean, it just blew wide open. I mean, we knew we had something special just from the very beginning, and you know, just knowing the family for years and exploring sort of opening it up to the extended family and interviewing Earl, you know, and some of the other members of the family.
Earl is your older brother, oldest brother,
yeah.
And the only one of the four who was not in the band.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and it just sort of opened the doors up, and then, you know, the more we talked to everyone, the more, you know, everyone was just mentioning David and, you know, and how special David meant to everyone in the family, and then, you know, getting, you know, acknowledgement from the community of musicians as well. Like, wow, these guys really have their chops. Not just in Vermont, but we're talking nationally, internationally, about the music. And you know, when you put the needle down on, you know, the album for the whole world to see. I mean, I as a musician just think it's. You know, in the top 10 of all-time records, myself.
Ask you about the, you know, the band's name, Death. David came up with the name.
Yes, he did.
And in the documentary, you and Dennis are reluctant at first, and then even more reluctant as things start happening. What was the rationale behind the name to begin with?
Well, you know, I mean, as I said, you know, David, when we had immersed ourselves in rock and roll, we didn't have a name. I mean, Rockfire Funk Express just didn't fit all this great new and exciting music we were playing. We wanted a rock and roll name. And so we milled around with a few names, but none of them seemed to roll off the tongue right. And, you know, I worked downtown and went to school and worked part-time downtown. Dennis worked downtown. And so when we come home, that would be our meeting time. And David says, summons up to the room. He says, come on, guys. He says, I got the name. I finally got the name. And we just ran up the stairs, you know, with bated breath. We were just waiting, you know, for this great name. And he looks at us with all the dramatic flair of any actor could ever muster up. And he says, I got the name. He says, what is it? He says, Death. And he looked at us like we were just supposed to love it right off.
Uh-huh.
And we were like, oh, man. I mean, we kind of saw the burden of that right away, you know.
Yeah.
We're like, man, people are going to be scared of us, you know. Or we're not like this dark and gory band. We don't want to be. But what he explained to us, when he explained to us the concept that, you know, as my brother Dennis says, that what David meant was that it wasn't, death was not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing. It's just a progression of life. It's just a progression of what we go through. So with that concept, and we saw that it was a much deeper meaning. I mean, he pulled us in, and we became impassioned about it just as much as he did.
Well, there are moments in the documentary, though, when, you know, when labels start backing away and saying, yeah, at one point you're ready to sign a contract, but they want you to change the name.
Right.
And it's David who
right.
sticks to his guns and says, no way.
That's right.
You exactly and Dennis are like, you're quoted in the film as saying, I would have changed it like
well, that. Yeah. That, you know, my brother Dennis says that, you know. I was the youngest guy, you know. And the thing about it is, you know, back during those days, I mean, our dad had instilled in us to always back up each other.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact of the matter is, in the 60s, you know, it was always that hierarchy. You know, like the oldest brother was second in command, and of course, you know, and David was the oldest of the group, though he mm-hmm. wasn't the oldest brother.
Earl was the oldest.
But you know, I mean, David had to. And he was the guitar player. I mean, in the '60s, the guitar player rules.
But
thanks
you,
to Jimi Hendrix,
you were the main songwriter.
Yeah, yeah. Well, David would. He always depended on me to write the lyrics because you know I had been a poetry writer from third grade. For the most part, David was just, he always told me, he said, I want you to express, you know, what I'm saying at the very beginning.
So he was not just the older brother. He was sort of the heart of the
Oh, yeah, he was.
Band.
He was the mentor. He was the one who was, he was kind of our director.
Yeah.
He was our director.
The band is Death. The film is A Band Called Death. Bobby Hackney is the bassist and vocalist from that trio, and Jeff Howlett, along with Mark Covino, put together this really terrific documentary, A Band Called Death, playing in select theaters and available nationwide on video on demand and iTunes. Jeff, having gone through the whole process of making this film and telling this story, how much of the travails, the, you know, the almost signed contracts, the almost record deals, how much of that do you put down to the name of the band?
I mean, it's, you know, it just weighs heavy, especially, you know, just the whole, you know, thing behind, you know, it's documented in the Clive Davis one, you know, they're not going to change their name for anyone and just sticking their guns. I mean, it was just amazing, you know, to see that after all that time, you know, I myself as a musician and a lover of punk rock, you know, from the time I was 12, I've been playing in different punk rock bands, and just to hear this stuff, I felt the same way as Julian, you know. Bob, why didn't you tell me about this?
Julian, I mean, being another of Bobby's
yes,
sons.
Yeah. And, you
so
know.
So you never told your own kids about Death?
Well, you know what? They had always, I mean, we went through a lot of rejection.
Yeah.
We went through a lot of rejection with Death.
Do you think it was all name related? Was some of it because you're three black guys playing rock music?
It was all name related. I
it
mean,
was.
You know,
okay.
But you know, it's funny because people asked us. They said, "Well, did you go through any racial?" I mean, it was really more or less in our own black community. I mean, that we went through that because it was like, look, we don't want to hear that. You guys should be playing Al Green, or you should be playing James Brown, or, you know, the Funkadelics, or
mm-hmm.
something. Make
mm-hmm.
us. And, you know, my brother even said that the girls, you know, in our community used to say, y'all better play something that could make us dance. You know, and they would say it just like that. So, you know, we went through a lot of that, you know. Like, they didn't want us to play rock and roll. They thought we should be playing something. And then we even had a couple of our friends who said, look, it's bad enough that you guys are three black guys playing rock, but your name is Death, you know. And so, you know, we went through a lot of rejection. And, you know, as a parent, you want your kids to see your successes.
Right.
You want them to gravitate to the things that you did right. And you know, I wanted to keep them in bliss because they knew us as reggae artists. We had marginal success with our band Lamb's Bread. They grew up seeing this. So we're like, look, why kind of go through that pain? I wanted to keep them in bliss. And we, you know, by the mid or the early 80s, we did like everybody else. We gravitated to Walkmans and CD players. So we didn't, even though those tapes were sitting up there that we brought from Detroit, we never had a reel-to-reel tape that was available to us. Not that we couldn't get one, where we could sit around on a Sunday and go, hey, kids, let's listen to some Death, you know?
Although, I think I would pay good money to hear a dad sit down and say to his kids, hey, let's listen to some Death.
Yeah.
Jeff, for me, the most striking moment in the film is when David, who dies in the year 2000, before he dies, brings those master tapes from Detroit to, is it Bobby, your house in Vermont?
Yes.
Hands them over and says, what?
He says, you know, Bob, I know you'll keep these. And, you know, Bob is a collector, right? Collector of many things. And, you know, he keeps them safe in his attic for all this many years.
Because he says, someday
the whole world will come looking for these.
Yeah,
and I know you'll have it.
So he knew, despite all the rejection, he had some inkling that somehow the world would beat a path to Bobby Hackney's attic in Vermont.
Well, he didn't really know it was going to be the attic, but he knew that I would keep him somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, what's really kind of poignant and painful for me and Dennis is that this all happened within 2 months before David died.
So what happens, Jeff? The bloggers, you know, get hold of one of those. The guys had printed up 500 copies of one of their singles on their own. They didn't get the record label. They didn't sign the deal. They released it on their own, and it sort of goes into obscurity. And somebody finds it. It's played at an underground DJ, you know, event. And these things start selling for like $800 on eBay if you can find them. So it was kind of an internet phenomenon, this rediscovery, right?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, just, you know, the post on Chunklet sort of went around, you know, it got around, and then, you know, that's when Robert Cole Manis, who is a very avid record collector and was working with Drag City Records out of Chicago, says, hey, you know, they came to him, you know, he said, hey, this is a great 7-inch, you guys should check this out, because he was one that actually, he bought the 7-inch and brought it to them and said, listen to this.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, this is great, you know, maybe we should maybe talk about maybe...
Was that Politicians in My Eyes, the single?
Politicians in My Eyes,
right,
and the Keep
One
on Knocking.
Yeah. Right.
And he said, you know, this is great, you guys should... You know, you should talk about putting this out. And they said, well, this is great, but maybe we should put out, you know, see if they have any more. And that's when a call came to Bobby from Robert saying, hey, do you have anything? And then, you know, the whole attic.
Where was the funny call that day?
They say there's no second acts in American Lives, but for Death, at least for you, Bobby, and your brother Dennis, there has been a second act, and now there's, after, what, 35, almost 40 years, a new single.
35, yes, yes.
Well, coming out later this month, called Relief.
Yes. You know, we basically, people have asked, you know, since the record came out, what's next? You know, well, we decided to take two new songs off of this new album and to put those out as a 45 single on vinyl, which will be released later this month. And, you know, it's going to be...
still doing it the hard way,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, still doing it the hard way. And it's going to look just like the single that we released in Detroit. And we're really excited about it. And we did this as an honor to David because we know David would love this. I mean, he would. That's the kind of thing that he would do.
The story of this band is an amazing tale, and it is told in this new documentary called A Band Called Death. It is playing at select theaters nationwide. It's also available everywhere on video on demand and iTunes. Jeff Howlett, one of the filmmakers on the line with me, Bobby Hackney, the bassist and vocalist of Death Then and Death Now, here with me in the studio. And guys, you end up at the end of the film just rooting for you, Bobby, and for Dennis. And it's just great have you here with us on Soundcheck today. Thanks very much.
Thank you, John.
Jeff, thank you, too.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next on Soundcheck, Punk Magazine was only around for a couple of years in the 1970s, but it played an important role in chronicling the early days of the punk movement. We'll talk with the magazine's co-founder next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the 1970s, punk first exploded here in New York, centered around clubs like the legendary CBGBs, and along with the bands, a magazine was born that had the same raw energy and gritty feel. For 4 years, the magazine chronicled and even helped define many of the names and faces of the time. It was called simply Punk. Now, a new book collects the very best of those 4 years. It is called, predictably, Punk, the Best of Punk Magazine. And the publication's co-founder, John Holmstrom, joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. John, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So very early on in the book, you put to bed a common misconception about Punk Magazine, which is that you guys came up with the term punk for this music.
Punk rock had been a term that had been in use for several years. Cream Magazine put Alice Cooper on the cover as Punk of the Year in 1974. Every time I'd read Cream, I'd read about punk rock, so I thought everybody in the world knew what it was. And now Suicide are generally acknowledged as possibly the first ever punk band.
Except that, what year are we talking about with Suicide? That's
1970 to
it's really early.
Whenever, yeah. Oh, yeah. They were the first band to call themselves punk on a promotional poster. And they really did that stripped-down minimalist sound, except they were a keyboard and a singer and a drum machine.
Right.
So people thought of them, well, they can't be punk because they're techno.
So the idea of punk as, you know, a couple of electric guitars, maybe a bass guitar and drums at full throttle, that idea hadn't, you know, that wasn't the definition of punk yet. There was no definition of punk yet. And that seems to be where you guys came in, Punk Magazine. In fact, you actually came up with a definition of punk, didn't you? Or a kind of a list of characteristics that define something as punk.
Yeah, I thought there was a common thread throughout the New York City rock scene at that time. Glam rock had kind of run its course, and there was kind of an anti-fashion look of the bands. But originally, punk rock meant what we now call garage rock. It was referring to the 1960s post-Rolling Stones bands.
Yeah.
And that attitude is what a lot of people think made you a punk. Like the Ramones came along, and people were saying, oh, my God, their songs are only 2 minutes long. And you go back to the Beatles' first records, all the songs are 2 minutes long.
The whole side of the record goes by in 13 or 14 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the late 60s, early 70s, you had, you know, post Sgt. Pepper, you had the rise of psychedelia, of progressive rock, and songs got longer and longer and longer. And the punks were really, as you say, they were kind of looking way back to the roots of rock and roll. And you mentioned the Ramones. I want to come back to them in a bit, but the Dictators. This was a band that meant a lot to you personally, right?
Yeah, well, I got that first record in the summer of 75, and I loved it because it was funny. The Dictators' Go Girl Crazy is the actual title of that record.
And what was it about this band that stood out for you?
To me, it was their sense of humor. It was funny, and rock and roll had stopped being funny by the 60s. All those people took themselves so seriously. And you go back to the great rock and roll, like the Coasters, you know, the novelty song. That's the kind of thing I liked.
Well, let's hear the Dictators. We're speaking with John Holmstrom, the cartoonist, writer, and co-founder of Punk Magazine from 1976 to 79. And this is from the album The Dictators Go Girl Crazy. I used to shiver in the wind. Dictators with The Next Big Thing from their album The Dictators Go Girl Crazy, some classic punk from the mid-70s. John Holmstrom's with me on Soundcheck. He's co-founder of Punk Magazine, and the new book is called Punk, the Best of Punk Magazine, collected from the 17 issues that were published between 1976 and 79. So, John, what made Punk Magazine different? It was not specifically a music magazine. I mean, it was called Punk, and it certainly, you know, you put people like Lou Reed and the Ramones and Debbie Harry of Blondie on the cover, but it seemed to be as much about art as it was about the music.
Yeah, it was art and humor. We wanted to be like the Mad Magazine of rock and roll.
And in terms of choices, decisions that were made of who to put on the cover, who to go after for interviews and stuff. As a startup in 1976, in a whole scene of startups, you end up with Lou Reed on the cover of the first issue, a guy who already had a long track record. Tell the story of how that happened.
Well, that was kind of an accident. If I had my choice of who to put on the cover, our first choice was the Dictators. Or I would have put Alice Cooper because he was the punk of the year and all that. But we went to interview the Ramones for the cover, and then he happened to be in the audience. And I was a big fan, especially because
this is
of his—
at CBGB's.
At CBGB's. Mm-hmm. He's just hanging out. And I had been a big fan of, still am, a big fan of his Metal Machine Music, which is a double album of nothing but guitar feedback and tape noise. I was thrilled to talk to him about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a great interview. And that put us on the map.
Right. And offered to buy your reel-to-reel tape deck from you.
Yeah, I had this little reel-to-reel recorder. I wasn't a professional interviewer. I'd never talked to anybody before.
Uh-huh.
So Lou saw this thing. Everybody was fascinated by it. But I got it from my uncle, who was an early sound fanatic. He had a recording studio in his basement, you know, going back to the 50s. And
so you would travel around with this thing, record your interviews, and then take it home or to the office, and you would hand write the transcriptions for the magazine.
Well, first I would transcribe it, and then I would hand letter an edited transcript.
So the magazine Punk, as you say, it's music, it's art, it's also humor. And in the book, in Punk, The Best of Punk magazine, you reference a band called The Sweet and their song Ballroom Blitz as a kind of like, you know, almost a point of reference, a touchstone for bands like the Ramones and the other early punks. What did you mean by that?
Well, I really think Blitzkrieg Bop was inspired by Ballroom Blitz, mm-hmm. as well as the Bay City Rollers. Early on,
Wait, the Bay City Rollers, they were this Scottish kind of boy band, mm-hmm. Very kind of squeaky clean image. I'm saying the image.
No,
I know what the reality was.
Okay.
But, you know, they were sort of sold to the public as like, this is music for your teenage daughters to listen to.
But you know, Bernard Brooke Partridge, who prevented the Sex Pistols from performing in the Great Britain back in the day, said there's only one band worse than the Sex Pistols, and that's the Bay City Rollers. So,
yeah, they were a randy lot of young men, weren't they?
That's what I heard. I never saw the show, but I've heard they were obscene.
So the kind of dual influences of bands like the Bay City Rollers and the Sweet, this is part of the mix that gives us the Ramones.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a better name now for what they did back then would be heavy metal bubblegum. You remember bubblegum music, right?
Yeah, yep. Kind of the lightest and frothiest of the pop.
Yeah, but it's kind of punk when you listen to it.
Yeah.
It kind of kept that going through the 60s.
The song we're talking about by The Sweet, Ballroom Blitz, was actually released in 1973, although it didn't really gain traction here in the States till 75. This is that song. That is The Sweet with their song Ballroom Blitz, kind of a major talking point in the development of the Ramones, of their sound, what came to be known as punk, but which, as John Holmstrom, co-founder of Punk Magazine, just told us, could easily have been called something completely different. Heavy metal bubblegum, was that your offering?
Yeah. It might have been a better name because the name punk took on a negative stigma from the beginning, and a lot of people just wanted to squash it.
Yeah, although, and you talk about this towards the end of the book, as, you know, recriminations are coming in from fans of bands that you didn't write about or fans of bands you did write about and didn't get signed, that the term punk was kind of a double-edged sword, you know. For some bands, like the Ramones and Blondie, being associated with the punk movement gave them a certain cachet and certainly helped get them their major record deals.
Right. And then once they got the record deal, nobody wanted to play the record because it was punk. I remember a story. Debbie Harry went to do an interview somewhere, and the DJ was afraid to talk to her because she might have a switchblade knife or something. You know, people took it very strange back then.
Well, now, let's talk a little bit about Blondie and especially about Deborah Harry. I mean, you know, there's photos of her there's one photo of her in the book here wearing only a guitar.
You know? I think one hidden weapon in Blondie's repertoire was Chris Stein. Now, Chris took those pictures of Debbie.
Mm-hmm.
Chris went to the School of Visual Arts, as I did, and a lot of people who worked on punk. And he's a very accomplished photographer. And he made Debbie look good.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think either one of them would have done anything that they felt was over the top.
Mm-hmm. She was one of the covers of the punk magazine. And again, the book is called Punk, the Best of Punk Magazine. So you get these images of Deborah Harry of Blondie, of Lou Reed. You did eventually get the Ramones on the cover. Let's hear a couple of excerpts from some of the artists that graced the cover of Punk Magazine, including the Ramones' Blitzkrieg Bop, a little bit of Blondie, and also later on, The Clash. Just some of the artists who were on the cover of old punk magazine between 76 and 79. The Ramones, who were supposed to be on the first cover, ended up on the third after Lou Reed was your first cover boy, John Holmstrom. We heard Blondie. And then The Clash, they were the last cover, right? The issue 17.
Yeah, The Clash were the last printed magazine.
Now, the Punk Magazine, I was telling you this before we went on mic today. I mean, I used to see the magazine, but I never actually bought a copy. I mean, I just didn't have the money. Was that the common problem? Was no one had money to buy the magazine? Is that why it eventually stopped?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. At first, that's what kept us struggling, is nobody was buying the magazine. We were only selling a few thousand copies in the States. In England, we were selling thousands of copies. It took off there. Like, the punk scene became big in London, as everybody knows.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It never really took off in the States until we were going out of business. By the time we'd finally gotten our act together, distributing the magazine and getting people to buy it, everybody thought punk was dead. And even though it was just beginning, the perception in the record industry was that we were finished. So it was a very strange situation to be in.
You mentioned Chris Stein before, the guitarist from Blondie, you know, photographer, took those images of Deborah Harry. At the end of the book, towards the very end, he tells you, you got to move the magazine up to the Bronx. This rap thing is going to be huge. And, of course, as you point out, he was right. He was always right. Why didn't you do it?
Well, it's not my music. I didn't have any passion for it myself. If I wanted to just make money, I guess I should have done that. But Chris was always one of my closest confidants, one of our most important contributors. Blondie and Chris were in, I think, every issue except for the first. Even though they were becoming, you know, big time and famous, they always had time to do something with the magazine, because they really loved it, and we were great friends throughout those years and later. He's a great guy, very smart.
And a great musician. We've been speaking with John Holmstrom, cartoonist, writer, co-founder of Punk Magazine, which ran from 1976 to 1979. And John, walk down memory lane. Thanks for taking it with us today.
Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed being on the program.
I'm gonna win ya. I'm gonna get you one way or another. I'm gonna see ya. I'm gonna meet ya one day. Maybe next week. I'm gonna meet ya. I'm gonna meet ya. I'll meet ya.
That's it for Soundcheck today. Thanks for listening. Our theme song was composed by New York keyboardist Marco Benevento. It's called Eagle Rock, and you can find out more about Marco and his music on our website, soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.